Welcome to Healing the World Through Music podcast. I'm Sherry Gross, bringing you conversations, experiences, and explorations on healing music and music for healing. You can find information on healing music events, tours, and trainings, as well as free gifts, music downloads, and all kinds of resources on music for healing at www.healingtheworldthroughmusic.com. Find yourself in a comfy spot and settle in because it's going to be an amazing episode. Thanks for listening. Today's interview is with Biachi Notaro, award-winning vocalist, guitarist, multi-instrumentalist, and songwriter who fronts the legendary San Francisco band Castles in Spain. The San Francisco Bay Guardian describes Castles in Spain as, "Imagine Jimmy Page and Robert Plant riding through the desert, kicking up dust and camel shit at some Cairo bazaar, where Chrissy Hynde is sitting in with Jane's Addiction, playing Black Sabbath and Middle Eastern folk music. The music is at once tough, lush, and hypnotic, often reminiscent of the epic-sounding Jane's Addiction." Sound like healing music? Well, listen to what Biachi has to say. Biachi caught the bug for singing and performing when she first appeared on stage with her mother, a famous professional singer, percussionist, and belly dancer from Bombay, India. At that time, Biachi was only 4 years old. Her love of rock and roll developed upon receiving her first drum kit at age 7. One of the objectives of the band for Biachi is to always be personal and original in their compositions, and this happens also thanks to Biachi's lyrics, compiled in a form hardly referable to the rock tradition and inspired by a deep reflection on the human condition. In this interview today, Biachi shares with us some of her experiences in performing at intense music festivals and events such as the San Francisco AIDS Walk. She shares with us some stories and some background about her own experiences with loss and healing, and shares some experiences that fans and audience members have had at her concerts. And I invite you to tune in to hear the rest of the story. The band has an amazing ability to speak to their audiences. And if you'd like to find out more about Castles in Spain, you can at YouTube.com/user/Castles in Spain. CastlesinSpain. Thank you.
Thank you for making me a part of this ebook. I'm really honored.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I thought it would be great to interview you because I know from time to time you've mentioned, you know, about your music being healing and different components of what you do and where you've performed. I know that your music definitely has a connecting and healing aspect in a lot of ways, and that's what I'd like to explore with you and ask you a little bit about. And I do have some specific questions lined up for you, but I wanted to give you first a little context, just the overview of the project so that you know what it's going for. I just want to have some practical stories of things that have happened to people. Music has healed them either by being in the audience and being the receiver hearing it, or by being the performer or the musician playing it. Introduction to the idea of music as a modality for healing.
Sure.
So, you know, with that in mind, I would just start by asking you how you first came to find out that music was healing for yourself and or for others.
I think as a very early age, my mother being a singer and performer in India, as a really little girl, I looked up to her and just admired her and, you know, would watch her sing. And I also saw this emotion in her, even at a very young age. And it was that emotion in her face and the way she delivered her vocals was so passionate. And there was like a pain in her face, but it was a way that she was releasing whatever pain she was feeling at the time, which had to be intense because you go from being really famous in India and having no boyfriends and no kind of real life as a kid and going to boarding school and then marrying this Marine and bringing her mother and her sister over, and then all of a sudden he goes off to Vietnam and she has two kids and she's thrown this different life. And I saw, as an early age, as a kid, I saw there was something going on with her. And I would just watch that and I would pick up from that. And I would just start singing myself. And it's almost like I channeled my mother through me. And I was able to forgive her for her mistakes. I didn't care. I saw her pain. I related to it in a weirdly strange way. And then when I started singing and performing, I felt that same kind of, it was almost like a subconscious thing, pain going on in my back of my mind that I couldn't really, I didn't understand it really, but I knew it existed. So I felt healing when I would sing as a real little girl. And then when I started playing guitar, which wasn't until I was in college, I just got a 12-string and I said, I need something else that I could, other than my vocals, another instrument that I could have go with my vocals. And all the songs I ever wrote, they were really emotional. I had no idea why. I couldn't really pinpoint what was bothering me, but it was just what I would notice. A lot of my lyric would come from observation on the human existence and it being, where it would be painful, but also some kind of a happy ending of faith and hope. But there's faith and hope. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Yes.
Yeah. So that, as a performer and as a writer, but that just happened naturally. I just felt like this release. And whenever I was done either writing a song or performing live on stage or even in the studio, once it was complete, I felt this huge release that I couldn't even quite put my finger on, you know. It's almost like when you feel like you're done with yoga.
Yeah.
Same kind of feeling.
Yeah.
And for other people, based on what I have people tell me after shows sometimes, or even watching them start at the front of the stage and then they go towards the back, and then they'll come up to me later and say, sorry if you saw me move back there. I started crying. Your songs make me cry, but it's a good cry. It's not a bad cry.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't depress me, but it pulls out emotion.
Mm.
So that's, yeah, pretty much it in a nutshell.
That's intense.
Yeah, very, very intense.
That's so amazing and interesting about, it's almost like you were born into this musical, the nuances and vibe of being, communicating through music.
Exactly. Exactly. Which makes it, it's a beautiful thing, but it's also kind of frustrating. It's hard to get our band shows, and not the beginning, because nobody really knew who we were in the beginning. They liked the name, and they thought we all looked cool. And people would see me with my tattoos and piercings and automatically think, oh, she's in a chick band, they play hard rock. And I'm like, no, quite the contrary. So they would come see us and go, whoa, you're a teddy bear, you're so sensitive. I'm like, yeah, I am. It's frustrating as an artist trying to do this for a living, because in the music industry, a lot of the managers or agents or record labels or publishers, they want to see you draw people. And we were getting quite a draw in the 90s when all the clubs were open in San Francisco for rock bands. That, you remember back when Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, they were all were getting big, because at that time we were in another recession and people were hurting, and they would go out and see these bands and they all were very emotional. Eddie Vedder, Chris Cornell, all these, and Kurt Cobain. These are artists who you could see were in pain of some sort, but they would release it through the music and people related to it. So we started getting that kind of connection, like, oh my God, you're like those kind of bands. And we had a following, and but things changed. Clubs closed, DJs got popular, people want to escape and dance and numb their pain and always just feel happy. So it kind of, it hurts me as a performer in many ways, because people don't want to go to bars and cry. And that's why we are meant for the big stage. So how do bands like U2 and Coldplay and all these bands who do heal through music, they heal people with their music, and they made it huge. I don't care about making it huge. I would like to make a living off of it. And the team that's around me, like you, Jasmine, who's invested in me, and my bandmates who are still with me after 8 to 10 years, get rewarded with some kind of income, not to be super rich, but just touring and sharing our music and making a living off of not being rock stars, but healing people through music.
Definitely.
And that was always my thing, even as a teenager. I said, I don't want to fit to any one genre. I don't want to be a punk band or a pop band. I want to be all these things. from Roberta Flack and Billie Holiday, and you listen to their music, and they're intense. And then
and the Ramones, too. And,
you know, all these kind of sad, melancholy, but really melodic artists is what made me go, I want to do that.
Yeah. I know, it's so powerful and so diverse. It's a mixture of all those things that makes it unique. What type of a venue and what type of an audience would be your people that would come? What environment would that be?
I think there's two angles. Actually, there's three angles. The first one is festivals, and I would say probably in Europe first, because they seem to be a lot more open-minded. With first, they'll hear, like, you know, Alanis Morissette, and then the next band will be Sepultura, heavy metal, and they're so open, and they like all those kinds of music. So the festival, I think, would be ideal, because it's a mass people that are ready to hear everything and anything. These are the kind of, whether they're kids or adults, that go out and see bands like Kings of Leon and Death Cab for Cutie and all these bands who made it big, who are very emotional. So the festivals would be number one, and equally with that is opening or supporting an act that's already made it, like it's a Kings of Leon or U2 or Coldplay. They're really big, but let's go even a scale down and bands trying to, Paramore, I think they're called, bands that have female front and they're kind of heavy and they rock, but they're intense and ambient. That would be like a beautiful venue, like Great American or Warfield. Even Bimbos was always a dream place for me to perform. Third thing is film, a drama that our song got in, big film that had a lot of money behind it. And so people are like, oh my God, that soundtrack, who is that band in that soundtrack? So when they get that, maybe that song makes it on the radio, people hear it enough and like see in the movie. And then when your band goes out and plays, you know, you have a sellout crowd. Those three things, I think, are the ideal situations. And politics plays such a huge role. And I know you've come across us as a booking agent, really good acts who have been at it for so long, who deserve to be on stage too.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about to indicate Castles in Spain as a healing type of music? Because I think that there's a context of music having healing properties. It has to be a certain type of music, that if it's a healing music, it has to be meditative, or it has to be like drums and percussion, or it has to be real ambient. Your music is not any of those categories, and that's why I want Castles in Spain in this project, as well as other types and styles and genres of music. You mentioned for your own music, you don't want to be pigeonholed into any certain genre or category, but music of any genre can actually be healing. And what is the component that's essential to be in the music if it doesn't have to be of a certain genre or a certain sound? What is it that makes it actually healing?
First and foremost, the melodies. Right up there next to the melody is the vocal delivery. Right after that is the intensity of the rhythm of the band. Whether it's in a shuffle type of rhythm or a tribal rhythm, something that pulls people from their guttural level. You know, it could be the drums and the bass, and then the melody from the vocals, of course. And then as far as just having Nisa on keyboards, my original drummer who played with me for 7 years leaves the band for almost 10 years and is back as my keyboard player, and he has added so much because I can't really bring the cello and the violin with me all the time. They were guests appearing on the record and sometimes for big shows. So Nice covers ambient keyboard part, which, you know, you just push down one key and the electronics going through massive speakers is just an instant gravitational pull towards the artist because it's so big sounding. It's frequencies. Frequencies of the low end and frequencies of what we call the mid-range, which is all vocals and melody. So pertaining to sounds, it's frequency, vibration, all that. You get instrumentals, like listen to Didgeridoo, for instance. And 30 seconds of that, people are like, already like robots are like, you know, they're already into it. And it's because of the frequencies that we don't even have control over. When you go to a concert and you hear they're playing background music and then the curtains open and they start out with the kick drum or the keyboard player holding down a chord that's really low, and it's that 60 hertz to like 800 hertz hum that is like a fish string, just like throw it out in the water and you just grab it, you know, you have absolutely no control over it.
Yeah.
It's a cool thing. That's why we are kind of a loud band, but there's good loud and bad loud. Good loud is when you know how to EQ your amp and not damage people's ears. And bad loud is just turning up and not really listening to the tone of your amplifier, or loud for the sake of being loud.
Right.
We are a very good loud.
Very powerful. Do you have any type of intention or a thought that you think or intend before performances? Is there anything in particular that you do before you play?
No, just pretty much, if there's a backstage, I'm just chilling and stretching my fingers for playing guitar and just relaxing and not talking too much because my voice tends to go hoarse if I talk too much before a show. So I don't really mingle too much with the audience. I did in the beginning, and then I learned my lesson. But yeah, just kind of relaxing and not really thinking about anything, really. Just relaxing. And, you know, I'm really not that nervous before a show because I realize most of the time the audience is on your side. You know, they're not there to judge you. Some are, and it's usually other musicians who are like, I heard this band's good, I want to check them out. And you got those competitive types, and then you've got the types that are just curious. And then you got the audience who just really wants to see you. Mm-hmm. And, of course, your friends who are just amazing. Mm-hmm. So I don't really do too much preparation except just relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The intention is to hopefully people feel, have some kind of feeling in their in their soul.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nice. So the last couple of years, excluding this year that you've performed with Castles in Spain at the AIDS Walk in San Francisco, and I know that you had a really close person to you die from AIDS, and I feel like that event must be a really emotional place for you to perform, and a lot of people who attend there probably have gone through a lot of emotion and loss with AIDS, and the whole that environment there must be really environment in need of healing, and I'm wondering if you have any particular experiences that you'd want to share around that.
Well, it happened so long ago that I'm able to even talk about it now without crying. Even like my brother died just 3 years ago, and not from AIDS, but I'll tell you, he looked like an AIDS patient right before I lost him. And that is hard. That comes through my mind now, more than anything, because David, who I lost to AIDS, reminded me of my brother so much. And my brother was alive, of course, when David was around. And he died, my brother was still somewhat healthy. So when I lost my brother, it reminded me of that all over again. And my brother, you know, my real brother. And it's just, I can't tell you, like, they're in my mind automatically without even any thought or hesitation. They're just there with me at all times, and they get me through performing and not breaking down during a performance. I had a thing at my David's funeral, and I just couldn't even get through the first line. I was bawling the entire time. And it was in a church, and you know, his casket was there, and I was like, oh Jesus.
Oh, yeah.
So it was hard. And then my brother, when I performed at the Haight-Ashbury Street Fair, it was just about 6 months after he passed. That was really intense, and I brought his ashes on stage with me and put it in front of this Shiva statue I have and burned it incense with it, you know, and that was, whoa, that was like having him with me, so,
What about the crowd and the people who come to those events? Do you kind of any either exchange of the vibration that you're sending out or the healing? Do you feel like people are absorbing that or they're soaking it up or any kind of a, is there any energetic type of a feeling that you get from playing there where you can tell like, wow, they really need it. I could feel that, you know, or something on your end that you receive from what you're putting out there for that?
Absolutely. And I see it in their faces. I see it in their faces because nobody's really smiling during our set.
Yeah.
And it's not because they don't like us. They're just like going, oh, my God, I better control my emotions. This is heavy. But they're not really heavy lyrics. It's the vibration. It's the sound. And, yeah, I see it all over their faces. I can feel their energy on stage, without a doubt. And even when I couldn't, when my eyes were so bad before I got my eye surgery, both my eyes had cataracts really bad at such a young age. And then after I had cataract surgery, they got even worse and had to have another surgery. And this was all just the past 2 years. So before that, I couldn't see really the faces of the people. But boy, did I feel them. Yeah, and it got me through the performance even more, though. I definitely feel, and now that I can see better, I can see it too.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that comes to mind that you'd want to, when you talk about your music and healing, any other specific experiences that you want to share in, you know, relation to this topic?
I would just say that pretty much after every show, and we don't have a lot of shows, but when we do, people will come up to me and say, thank you, and I needed that today.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, wow, you're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
It happens at every single show, or even after someone says, I heard your record, and man, I mean, it's great driving music because it puts me in a place where I can just kind of let go and release. And then people have told me they've listened to my record just for a therapy session for themselves, a musical therapy session. Mm. And that is like the biggest mm-hmm. compliment I could ever get.
Totally.
And another big compliment is when I could move a crowd that's into totally different music. Like, a really good example, there's two examples. There's the R&B crowd. They're all in soul, and, you know, they listen to nothing but R&B and soul, sometimes hip-hop, and then the heavy metal crowd, which is totally different, very angry, angst, heavy, let all that anger out. And they'll come up to me and go, man, that was heavy, and I needed that, or, man, girl, you got a lot of soul, you know? And to me, I'm just, like, glowing. I'm blissed out when people come up to me and say, oh, I'd rather them tell me, you made me cry, or I really feel you, or you got soul. I'd much rather hear that than, hey, man, your band's really rocking, you know, just really shallow.
Mm-hmm.
I just, even though I appreciate it, it doesn't mean as much to me as someone saying, I cried, or your music's therapy, or you're so soulful, and
yeah.
That is an ultimate compliment.
Yeah, that's great about listening. You said as a musical therapy session, like, who do you think would be, if you had to kind of describe your tribe of people that would come to, that may not have heard your music before, but that could be candidates that you feel would really enjoy it and benefit from it, and you wanted to describe them with some characteristics or emotions that they might be going through at the time, like, what would those be?
Honest to God, I would say anyone and everyone from age 5 to 90. That's how eclectic the music, and that's how eclectic our crowds are. I have complete confidence, and it's because I know we're lacking exposure, but when you throw us in front of any crowd, punk, hippies, kids, when I went up to Weed, these kids were just completely mesmerized, and we lost all our power, and I just got my acoustic, and I sat down on the pavement and played for the kids, and they were completely captivated. And then I'll have people in wheelchairs that are barely can hear, that they feel the vibration through the sound.
Mm.
So I can't, that's what's so difficult, is that I can't say, oh, pretty much the baby boomer crowd, or I can't even say that, because I know for a fact, I have 100% confidence that it's everyone and anyone.
Love it.
Yeah, like I said, I'm just so honored, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad you're participating. But I think
great.
It's great, Biachi. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time and your input.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Okay, Biachi. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, isn't that amazing? Thank you so much for joining us today and listening to this episode of Healing the World Through Music. Do check our website for your free tools on healing music and music for healing, including your own healing music blueprint, which is a new exciting offering that you'll find at www.healingtheworldthroughmusic.com. Thank you.